You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. It is always a pleasure to welcome as a guest speaker an experienced minister from elsewhere in the world. No, not just because it gives me a break from preaching, and not because you are so very addicted to variety, but because any Unitarian Universalist church has much that it can learn from the wider UU movement and from that most obscure part of its history, the recent past. The tyranny of our distance means it is easy not just to feel isolated, but to actually become parochial and inward-looking. Inward focus in a church is a recipe for destruction. Inward focus is a church killer, so we ignore the wider movement at our peril. Further, it's a particular pleasure to welcome a minister whose tenure extends so far back into the recent past that it predates Facebook, Skype, even Google. It's easy for a youthening church to forget that we did not invent this free faith. We did not invent it. We inherited it from such brave and gentle, fierce and outspoken souls as our guest. To ignore our legacy is likewise to court parochialism and to invite replaying on this remote stage the struggles of our movement's history. The Reverend Dr. David Johnson served as a full-time minister to Unitarian congregations in the U.S. for the last 30 years and retired a year ago. Prior to his ministry, Dave was a marine geologist for 20 years at Scripps and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institutes. This morning, Dave will reflect on the challenge of distinguishing between stuff that's true and stuff that matters. So with pleasure and gratitude, I invite him now to the pulpit.
Well, good morning, friends. My thanks to your minister, Reverend Rob McPherson, for his kind invitation today. One day exactly a half a century ago, a scientist from here in Adelaide, Bill Riedel, became my mentor and graduate research supervisor. He walked into my office one fine day and invited me to be chief scientist on an upcoming expedition to the South Pacific. Bill trusted me. Fortunately, that particular expedition was a great success, and it paved the way for what became my first career in marine geology. This week, I've had the very good fortune to reconnect with Bill, my mentor from a half century ago. Last evening, we met at Vintner's Bar and Grill out in the Barossa Valley to toast the occasion. I must confess, however, that we neglected to include Adelaide floaters or pie floaters, whatever you call them, in our cuisine. That will have to await another occasion. I'm sometimes asked, why did you abandon a respectable career and shift into ministry? Today, I want to offer three short vignettes as a partial response. And Mr. Cummins's quote is perhaps a wonderful condensation of all I would hope to say. Three vignettes. The little girl stood up on her tippy toes, peering over the rim of a mushroom, and on top She saw a giant green caterpillar rocking back and forth, puffing on a hookah. The caterpillar and Alice looked at each other in silence, and at last the caterpillar addressed her in a sleepy voice. "Who are you?" asked the caterpillar. "I hardly know," said Alice. "I know who I was, this morning, but I must have changed several times since then. I'm not myself, you see. I'm not myself. I was not myself long ago. On a summer day when my mom and dad divorced, I had no home that I wanted to go back to. I didn't want to go back to college. And so, like Jonah, I ran away to sea. I found my way to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and read the notices of upcoming expeditions. I found one. One of the biologists was heading out in just a few days to a place called Ponta Delgada. I had never heard of Ponta Delgada, so it qualified as the end of the earth. I wandered into the scientist's office, Dr. Backus. I said, "I'll work for you for nothing if you will take me out to sea." He said, "Great." I got a passport. We set sail. It was a dark and stormy night. I was on the midnight to 4 a.m. watch. Charlie, a burly Irishman, was the watch leader. Before the watch ended, we had a final task to go out on deck and launch a BT, a bathythermograph. It's a torpedo-shaped instrument about so long, which measures a vertical profile of the ocean water temperature. You lower this thing down on a wire a couple of hundred meters, bring it back, and inside the BT on a glass slide, a needle scratches a vertical profile of the ocean temperature. In nice weather, this is routine. In a gale, it gets a little bit messy. There was a gale that night. Charlie and I stumbled out on deck, and we made our way up to where the winch operator was all set to lower the BT. We clamped it onto the wire. The winch operator lowered away. All went well. It looked like we were going to finish this operation. Before the wire came in, however, something went a little bit wrong. We noticed that as the wire was being hauled in, the wire had worked its way underneath the hull of the ship. Now, as you might imagine, a steel cable being hauled in at high speed acts like a chainsaw. And if we had kept that going, the ship might have sprung a serious and major leak. The winch operator noticed. He stopped the winch. At that point, I made a gesture up toward the bridge, something like this. Now, as everybody knows, this gesture in universal sign language means the wire has worked its way under the ship, turned the bow around into the wind to get the wire out from under. Somehow, the second mate up on the bridge wing interpreted my gesture to mean, "We're done, let's get underway." The propellers churned, the wire went slack, the BT went to the bottom. I feared that I might be tossed over, just like Jonah. Shortly after the watch ended, Charlie, the watch leader, summoned me into a quiet area, the ship's library, for a little sit-down. I figured, okay, it's time that I be held accountable. What happened was rather fascinating. What Charlie said to me was in a very even-keeled voice, "Ease up on yourself. Stuff gets lost. This is tough work out here. Things go wrong, especially in storms. And so we always carry spares. Down in the hold, we have spare winches and core pipes and BTs, toolkits." Charlie was giving me a very even-tempered message, low-key, reassuring me that all was going to go well. He assured me that I was not going to be tossed overboard by the captain and the chief scientist. But now, in hindsight, I realized that Charlie was conveying two messages to me. The spoken message was informational. Things break, things get lost, we're going to be ready to go again. That was his informational message. But there was a second message, a message not of facts, but of relationships and values. a message not of the head, but of the heart. Charlie was saying to me, non-verbally, "We trust you. Your presence on board this ship matters. All of us seasoned veterans, we also bumbled. Your mistake is a learning opportunity for you. It will strengthen your effectiveness as a seagoing scientist. You've learned about clear communications on board ship. You are developing the resilience and agility to keep on keeping on, even when things get wacky. Stay with it. You are not alone." Now, I just made up those words. Charlie didn't speak those aloud. And now, however, in hindsight, I know that this is the second message he was sending. Not an informational message, but a transformational message. Something that would restore and bring healing to what had seemed to be brokenness. A second vignette. Have some of you perhaps heard the violinist Itzhak Perelman? You may know that as a child he was stricken with polio, and he wears braces on both legs and walks with crutches. When he's performing and enters the stage, he walks with difficulty, slowly and yet majestically, toward his chair. He sits and puts his crutches on the floor and unlocks the clasps on his legs. He bends down, picks up his violin, puts it under his chin, nods to the conductor, and proceeds to play. And audiences are used to this majestic kind of ritual as Itzhak Perelman prepares to play his violin concerto or whatever the piece may be. Now, one evening at Avery Fisher Hall in New York, something went wrong. Just as Perelman finished the first few bars of the piece, one string on his violin snapped. You could hear it throughout the hall. There was no mistaking what the sound meant, and no mistaking what Mr. Perelman would have to do. He would have to slowly get up, put on the clasps on his legs, pick up his crutches, make his way off stage, either to find another violin or to find another string for this one. But he didn't do so. Instead, he waited for just a moment. He closed his eyes, and then he signaled for the conductor to begin once again. The orchestra began, and Perelman began playing right where they had left off, playing with passion and purity as the New York audiences had never heard. Now, we know that it is impossible to play a violin with just three strings, but Mr. Perelman did not know that night. You could see him modulating, recomposing the piece in his head, and at one point it appeared that he was even detuning one or more of the strings to get new sounds out of it. When he finished, there was an awesome silence in Avery Fisher Hall. Then the applause was overwhelming. Mr. Perelman raised his bow, smiled, signaled the audience that he wished to speak. He wiped the sweat from his brow, and he said, not boastfully, but in a quiet, pensive, reverent voice, "You know, sometimes it is the artist's task to find out how much music you can make with what you have left. You know, I had a stroke 4 years ago. It hit just as suddenly as that violin string snapped. Happily, the stroke didn't do me in. I'm back here. I've got a little bit longer. I'm with you today." And yet, to my surprise, the weeks of inpatient rehab that I went through became one of the most powerful learning opportunities I've ever had. I'm quite serious about that. Here's one example. Each evening, I opened up my laptop computer. I loaded the vocal score of Brahms' Ein Deutsches Requiem and linked it to a YouTube audio of the score of this piece of music. So I had the visual of the score on the screen, I had the audio coming through my ears, and doing my best to articulate the German was able to begin the healing process of reconnecting the damaged part of my brain with the damaged part of my vocal cords so that when I got out of rehab 6 weeks later, I would be able to rejoin the chorus and make music for our scheduled concert appearance, making some music with what I had left. I had more time.
Fantastic.
So my question for us today, friends, is how shall you and I continue to make music upon the strings and with the time that remains for us? How shall we come to terms with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, the contingencies, the stuff that's not fair, not deserved, not predictable, not controllable, but there it is, the crashes? How shall we recompose our life's music? And how shall we do so with faith? Faith, you know, is one of those F words that we Unitarians need to reclaim. Faith is not superstition. It's not believing what ain't so. Faith is simply trusting ahead of time in the unfolding of events, which may, in hindsight, be somewhat clearer. And one can say that without using any theistic language. You can simply say that because of the asymmetry of history, with faith, we can trust in the unfolding of events, which in hindsight just might make a little more sense. That's what faith is. It's honoring the radical asymmetry of history. And one can say that without using religious language. A third vignette. Long ago, I taught a Sunday school class of seventh graders in a Unitarian church. This was before I entered the ministry, but I decided to have a go at teaching Sunday school. A class of seventh graders. And one day I posed a thought experiment to them. I said, suppose that you could know for sure that you will never die. Suppose right this minute you knew that you shall live forever. What might you do next? I just watched and listened. And it was remarkable. The kids did not celebrate joyfully as if they were finally free and could do anything. It was quite the opposite. They became zombies, stumbling around, mumbling, incoherent, in a kind of timeless, boundaryless maze of indifferent blather. And then I realized these kids understand the mystery and the secret of life. If our lives had no deaths, no boundaries, no closures, we would become like zombies. Without death or deadlines, nothing would matter. Nothing would matter. Life would be an indifferent shrug, a bland whatever. If we had all the time in the world, our choices would not matter. You recall Homer's Odyssey, in which the goddess Calypso envies Odysseus and other humans. Why? Precisely because humans are mortal. Every choice is a courageous act. It is in deadlines wherein lies our salvation. As a minister, I valued the deadlines of sermon preparation each week. That deadline saved me from paralysis, keeping my options open forever and ever and ever. Sorry. Salvation by deadline has become my mantra. It's somewhat like a mother bird teaching its fledglings to flap their wings by kicking them out of the nest. It's time to hit the print button or to close it out. This is it. Salvation by deadline saves me from indecision and also from perfectionism. Yes, with a bit more time, I might have done better, and I might not. No matter. The time comes for each of us to do or to die. And so we did, and we lived. No matter the results, we are done. It's over. If left to our own devices, we might never finish. We would be like a young child who just won't go to bed. But eventually the curtain comes down and our eyelids close And we are borne aloft and at last on eagle's wings to our rest. Let me close with a short creation story, one which is also about salvation in a way. It's about being saved from bland indifference and instead to engage this wonderful life more fully. This is a story adapted from T.H. White's novel, The Once and Future King. The story is told by the badger, and it calls us to the creative possibilities which are ours in every moment. Once upon a time, long ago, God created many different forms of life, and yet instead of each creature being fully developed, each was a primitive and vulnerable embryo. They looked very much alike, not yet having the particular features required for later specialization. And in their very raw, vulnerable condition, God decided to give each one of the embryos a choice. So God summoned all the embryos, and he offered each one any specialization that they desired as they matured into their adult forms. And so one by one, each embryo chose what they hoped might be an advantageous quality. Some chose sharp claws. Some chose sharp eyesight. Others the ability to fly. And others a warm, insulated coat, and so forth. Last of all, the human embryo approached God. "If you please," said the human embryo, "I can only imagine that I already have those particular shapes and gifts and qualities and capacities for reasons that are far beyond me to understand, and it would be rather rude to change. And so if I am to have my choice, then I shall stay as I am. I will not alter any of the parts which have been given to me. I may be rather defenseless all my life, just doing my best to make for myself a few feeble implements out of the world around me, the wood, iron, and other materials which you have seen fit to leave for me." "Well done," exclaimed the Creator. "Come over here, all you other embryos. Come over here and look at our first human being. Look with all of your beaks and claws and long necks and muscles and whatnots. Come over here and look at our first human being. For this is the only one who has guessed the riddle of life. As for you, O man, you will remain eternally incomplete, eternally undeveloped. You will always remain potential in our image. You will see some of the eternal joys and sorrows. We are partly sorry for you, but we are hopeful. We are very hopeful. So run along then and do your best. Run along then and do your best."
Blessed is the path on which you travel. Blessed is the body that carries you upon it. Blessed is your heart that has heard the call. Blessed is your mind that discerns the way. And blessed is the gift that you will receive by going. Truly blessed is the gift that you will become on the great journey. You go in peace. Amen. And have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.